welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. A very, very special edition, an OG's OG edition. It's an OG edition of the OG podcast. My buddy, my partner in crime forever, no matter what, my best friend, the doctor, Jimmy Bucciolato. JB's back for a very fascinating case study that we're going to do this week and talk about John Willis from Boston's Chinatown, a gangland prodigy of sorts, Irish kid, grew up in Southie Dorchester, who gets informally adopted by a member of the Chinatown Ping Ong gang in the 80s. Over the next 20 years, it rises to meteoric heights. But part of this is going to be me and Jimmy, dissecting mythology and what's myth and what's true. There's been a lot of mystique built around John Willis. He's out of prison, been gone for about 15 years, walked out in the last week or two, checked into a halfway house. JB, thank you for joining me.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. It's feels good to be back. Nice to see everyone. This is a case study that I think is pretty interesting. And so I look forward to discussing it. It's definitely different.
I knew this was, Jimmy and I have talked about doing, maybe a guest spot here or there. A lot of the reason he left was just, there's bandwidth in everybody's lives. But I think he still has a desire and itch to sometimes come on and discuss and analyze. But we didn't want to just pick any old story or breaking news, or we wanted to wait for something that was right in that sweet spot. And I think this is it. It's a truth is stranger than fiction type narrative. Even if the mythology, the size of the mythology is inaccurate, mm-hmm. just take away the mythology and just straight facts, it's pretty impressive, unheard of. It's a very compelling case study that I think Jimmy would have been excited when I was thinking about asking him to jump in on. And I'm glad that he decided.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I agree with you, even though I think the mainstream kind of narrative is a little bit doesn't quite hit the mark. It's still a fascinating case study regardless. This guy led a really interesting life, and it ties into all sorts of different things about the Boston underworld. But yeah, this is, when I was part of the podcast full time, this is precisely the kind of episode I would have probably picked and come up with. I always really liked the sort of like some of our episodes we did on the cartels, Russian organized crime, things that were a little different. This one's Asian organized crime. We did the big Asian organized crime episode not long before I left the podcast. And this is definitely, these kinds of case studies, I don't know how many views it'll get. Some of my favorite episodes that I picked weren't always the most popular, but I think they're fun to talk about.
There's a timely nature to this right now, so I don't want to bury the lead. Let's try to get in the first 5 minutes that he's out of prison now. He's free. He's 55. He went away when he was 41 or 42. He came on the scene, again, separating fact from fiction. It's a fact. He came on the scene when he was 15, 16, 17 years old, as a orphaned white Irish kid adopted by a Chinatown mob figure named Johnny Joe, Vaping Joe, Vapor Joe, introduced into that very high stakes world. Mm-hmm. So that's undisputed. But I think there is there's something to be said about what the socio-academic, take away the glitz and glamour, there's like a real like meaty piece of, you know, socioacademic research here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely interesting. I mean, when we talk about organized crime groups from like a criminological perspective, usually they're very segregated. And I don't mean necessarily segregated in terms of the rackets that they, we know different crime groups work with each other all the time, but in terms of like operating within the crime group, I mean, it's not very common for a person who's of European descent to be, you know, rising through the ranks of an Asian organized crime group. It just,
at a young age,
and to happen rather quickly too. It's very unusual. I mean, sometimes, you know, you'll see a guy like Stevie Flemmi, who's Italian, and he becomes a big guy in the Irish mob.
Yeah.
You'll have Jimmy Burke, who's an Irish guy who, you know, carries a lot of weight, and he's not a made guy, but he carries a lot of weight.
Joe Morgan, Peg Leg,
right. Meyer Lansky, whatever. So you do have these examples, but in terms of Asian organized crime, this is one of the few examples or only example I'm aware of, you know. So anytime these things happen, I think they're interesting from, as you point out, a sociological perspective, because these groups tend to be very segregated.
So before we deep dive this and go backwards, just, you know, start from kind of the beginning, why this is timely, in addition to him coming out of prison, it's been, like I said, almost 15 years. I think he got locked up in 2011. He's a suspect in an open homicide investigation that has gotten media attention in the last couple months. There's a 30-year anniversary of the murder of a Chinatown mob figure. We'll get into it later. They called him Perfect Paul. I have his name written down, his real name written down. And it was from spring of 1995. And him and one of his mentors, who we'll get into, one of the godfathers that he worked under, are still considered suspects in this homicide. And it could be something that hangs over his head as he goes on and tries to, you know, have that second chapter of his life. And if he has the desire to flip the script and turn over a new leaf, it could be something that's just, you know, that other shoe could drop. I doubt that this is something that can be solved. Well, I'll go over some of the specifics when we get into it. I doubt that this is something that there are eventually going to be charges or indictments.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't believe in coincidences, and I don't think it's a coincidence that they're letting him out now, weeks after the media in Boston and New Hampshire. It was believed that this guy was killed in Chinatown, and his body was dropped in New Hampshire, and both you know, media corps, press corps in New Hampshire and Boston have been talking about this in the last couple of weeks. Again, I don't believe in coincidences. I think that this is, you know, calculated on the part of the government. But on the other hand, I don't really see that a 30-year-old murder eventually mm-hmm. being brought.
Yeah, pretty difficult case to make. Yeah.
So
you want to start from the beginning with this?
Yeah,
guy?
I mean this guy originally born into a Southie Irish Union family. Guy that had ties to Whitey Bulger, his dad. Eventually, they moved to Dorchester. Was a hockey player as a young boy. And then his dad left the family. His mom ends up dying of health issues. And as a 15-year-old, he's like homeless.
Basically raising himself, yeah.
Yeah, and then it's 1985, you know, right when crack was just ravishing these cities, these low income areas, and housing projects, and, you know, Dorchester and Roxbury, and, you know, those those like those are really tough neighborhoods. Some altercation happens, kind of shows that he's a tough guy, and this Johnny Joe takes notice and takes an interest, and I guess introduces himself. And according to, I want to shout out, you know, Rolling Stone, the author of the book, that was released 10 years ago or so. We'll give him a name shout out at the end of that. I'll get into the coverage of him after he got locked up. But, you know, according to that narrative, some of this based on interviews with John Wells, who went by Bakwai, which meant white devil, John. Mm-hmm. So he is in some type of physical altercation, catches the eye of this Chinatown mob lieutenant who comes up to him. They have some type of face-to-face meeting. The mob lieutenant leaves, and then like moments later, like a limousine pulls up and two of Johnny Joe's lieutenants come, and they're like, you know, come with us, you're not with us. And they get him dressed and they give him food and women. It's like they're off and running.
It happens pretty fast. David Kushner, I think, is the author of the Rolling Stone article, which is a lot of people. That was like my point of departure the first time I became aware of this case study. But my understanding is that so he's basically raising himself. I think he was like social services thought he was being raised by his sisters, but they had a house, but actually they had their own problems and they weren't there ever. So he was basically raising himself. And he's a tough guy. He starts lifting weights, plays hockey, he can handle himself. And he becomes a bouncer at a local bar. And one night of the week at this local club happens to be the night that most of a lot of the people from Asian American neighborhoods hang out at, like this particular night. So he starts to get exposed to some of these guys, but he doesn't really know like who they are, what's up with them. But he is starting to like get exposed to that universe. And right, there's an altercation where I think he beats up somebody who's acting out, who's affiliated with that world. And some of the guys are going to intervene, like these sort of, you know, Asian or Chinese gangsters. And John Joe is like, says, no, leave him alone, because he's sort of he for whatever reason he takes to Willis and gives him a card and says, if you ever need anything, give me a call. And then eventually he does, right? And then he's introduced, like, not slowly, but like day one, like he goes to their hangout. There's guns everywhere, cash everywhere, prostitutes. Like, it's pretty fast.
He hit the ground running. I mean, it was zero to a thousand,
right?
And the author of the book was Bob Halloran, White Devil John. It came out, like I said, I think about 10 years ago, I believe. Was the name of the book. So let's try to set the scene of what Chinatown late 80s was like. You had the boss of bosses at that point. His name was Sky Dragon. His real name was Stephen C.
Stephen Say.
Stephen Say. And he was a OG, as they say, 14K triads, Chinese guy, came from Hong Kong, got here in the early 70s, was in New York for a period of time, popped up in the Boston PD and Fed radar in the mid 70s. In 77, I believe he joined Hung Mon gang. And then by the early 80s, he created Ping Ong, which was his own Boston Chinatown group.
Ping On, I think P-I-N-G-O-N, Ping On.
Yeah. I think he had some help in the 70s from a guy they called Harry Mook, who was a Godfather type, and obviously had the backing of his triad group. And he was the Kingfish. And he had an office at what was called the Freemasons building on Tyler Street. And for people that are unfamiliar with Chinatown in Boston, it's small. The Chinatown there is on Tyler Street. That's kind of the heart of it. It's like Mulberry, Canal Street. Well, like Canal Street is in New York for Chinatown. Tyler Street is for Boston Chinatown, kind of like what Mulberry Street is for New York, Little Italy. He has a office in the Freemasons building there and has a restaurant called the Kung Fu, which is like the epicenter of Chinatown mob activity at that time period. And White Devil John starts being there, was spending time there, around there. And because he stuck out. I mean, it was hard to not notice him if you were a police officer or a federal agent doing surveillance. It'd be difficult not to notice a white, almost blonde, teenager hanging out with all these smaller Asian crime lords.
I think they surveilled him dropping either making collections or something like that. So right away, they put it, like, he wasn't on their radar. They said
to him until he made it so they had to pay attention.
Right, right.
And I think that was actually, I think that those were comments made by different eras of investigation. Mm-hmm. I think that was said by the people that were watching him as a teenager and in his early 20s. And then again, when he was in his mid to late 30s, when he was becoming an entity in his own right as kind of a kingpin, not necessarily a Chinatown kingpin, just a kingpin. They also said that. I think this is actually a great time to do this kind of, what's real, what's lore, what's urban myth, because there's a lot of conflicting reports about what was John Willis's connection, direct or indirect, to Sky Dragon. And it goes from, it runs the gamut from he was Sky Dragon's right-hand man when he was 16, to he never met Sky Dragon as a teenager and then met him later in life. It's quite the gap in. He says in that Rolling Stone interview that he did not meet him. That Willis says he didn't meet Sky Dragon until he was an adult.
Yeah, that was my takeaway too. And by the way, the guy Sky Dragon, Stephen Say, I mean, to be a member of the 14K triad, I mean, that's no joke. I mean, that's like, if for people who are more familiar with researching Italian organized crime, I mean, that's like saying you're a made guy in Cosa Nostra. You know what I mean? Like he's the real deal.
You get your Bonafides.
Yeah, that's an organization that goes back to anti-communists fleeing Maoist China and going to Taiwan and Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And the 14K triads, I mean, they have a presence in New York, all across, Europe, North America. So this guy's the real deal. And he was the boss. So they would call him the Godfather in the neighborhood. They would refer to him as the Godfather, which is kind of interesting. The kind of, like, you see the popular culture that even within the Chinese community, right, they know what that means, right? So they refer to him as the Godfather of Chinatown. So that's without question. He's the real deal. He's subpoenaed to appear before a presidential commission on organized crime. He doesn't go. He flees. He gets in trouble for that. I guess the question is, at what point this guy and you know, the White Devil, at what time do they intersect, I guess, right. is what's up for debate.
I guess you could also, you know, if you're going to play the point-counterpoint, if you're John Willis and you're being interviewed by Rolling Stone and you're, it's all over with, you're in prison, you're look, you know, at that point, you're looking at another 15 years. Wouldn't it benefit you to overplay your significance if you're going to look at it from a, you know, this guy, what was the motive to lie or tell the truth? Wouldn't you go the opposite direction? And he'd be like, yeah, I was 16 years old and I was driving Skydragon around. Instead, he says, yeah, I didn't really ever meet him until later in life when he approached me when he was out of prison and bought me a drink.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it'd be great to, I don't know if he feels comfortable at some point going public, but it'd be great to interview him and, you know, ask him again to clarify that.
Well, just to deep dive it a little bit more. Well, you know, I guess it doesn't take, Sigmund Freud to understand how, you know, the telephone game and how myths are built.
Oh, sure. So, of course.
I saw it with White Boy Rick in my reporting, which was kind of like a cousin to White Devil John in Detroit about a white.
There's a parallel.
White teenage drug dealer who was at. The difference is White Devil John wasn't a creation of the federal government.
Right.
And White Boy Rick was recruited at 14 years old to infiltrate drug gangs, mostly black drug gangs, and did a very, very good job and was a this type of fish out of water who exceeded any expectations of anybody. The White Boy Rick in Detroit was 16, 17 years old and white teenager running around with the most dangerous, powerful black drug kingpins. And I saw it firsthand in my reporting there about how things that didn't need to be exaggerated. There's no need to exaggerate. It's an amazing story. No need to make it more than it is, because what it is so spectacular.
Yeah, it's already interesting. Right.
Right. But it happened. I mean, I can't tell you how many people came up to me before Rick got out. And there's this mythology in Detroit that Rick had all this money buried, you know. He left a fortune behind in his backyard. Yeah. And I'm like, dude's broke as a joke. I see it. You know, he ain't got no money buried in a backyard somewhere in east side of Detroit.
Well, yeah, there was even a thing, you know, I would hear even in the 90s, people saying that they ran with White Boy Rick.
Oh, yeah.
People now saying they ran with White Boy Rick in the 90s. And I'm like, I don't think White Boy Rick was around.
I'm sure there's probably some in Southie. There might be some, you know, similar, you know, the way that people talk about White Devil John. Like, well, oh, yeah, I knew him. We used to hang out all the time. And it's just it's currency, whether you might have seen him once across the street. But in the story that you tell 20 years later, oh, yeah, we used to hang out all the time.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And in the underworld, I think that, you know, like that can happen. But I mean, I think regardless, I mean, one thing that's interesting, regardless of at what point he intersects with Skydragon, there's no doubt he is assimilating into the Asian underworld in Chinatown. And he is learning Chinese. Right.
So
go ahead.
No, Johnny Joe teaches him the people around Johnny Joe's family three languages: Mandarin, Cantonese, and Vietnamese.
Yeah, but a lot of it he was also self taught. Like he was watching Chinese media and things like music, you know, trying to pick up different things, which is again pretty extraordinary. And he's also listening to these guys in terms of the values, like how to conduct yourself. Don't lose your temper. Don't draw attention to yourself, things like that. And they're putting him to work. Like, he's a big dude. We've already talked. He can handle himself. He's a weightlifter, plays hockey. He's a tough guy. And these basically they're employing him as a collector, because in Chinatown, again, there's a lot of parallels with Italian mafia, old school Italian mafia. The Chinese organized crime groups, they're running loan sharking, gambling dens, brothels, extortion.
Everybody pays.
Right. So it's very similar to the same types of rackets that Italian organized crime groups are involved in, if not identical.
Selling disputes.
Right. And so he is very useful as a big, tough guy. And he is being used as a bodyguard, a collector, and really becomes fully immersed in this environment where he basically doesn't even really hang out with his Irish buddies anymore from Dorchester, because he's so immersed in this culture. That part is fascinating, no matter what. To your point of like, you could just end it there. That, and deep dive that is really, really remarkable and interesting to me.
So as the 80s come to an end, and this is, you know, there are dozens of analogies across a wide array of organized crime spaces, multiple ethnic groups in multiple cities, that this was a time period where there was a lot of money being made. There was a boom in the regular economy, which also coincided with a boom in the underworld economy in the late 80s. And as a result, a lot of areas and gangland landscapes erupted into war. And Chinatown in Boston was no different. And Sky Dragon and the Ping Ong came under attack around 1988. The war started. It's said to have ended around 92. And him and his group were under attack by like a consortium of Vietnamese street gangs led by a guy named Tan Ngo, or
Tan. I think you would pronounce it Tan Go, but I'm not.
Tan Go, also known as Bai Ming.
Tan No, I think is how you would pronounce it. My apologies to.
It's NGO. So Tan No. AKA Bai Ming or Bike Ming, which I believe is translates to the clear-eyed one. I guess the reputation on the streets was he was a small guy, a very small guy, not very intimidating looking, but wielded a pretty big stick and was able to consolidate a lot of different groups to oppose Sky Dragon. And it's a pretty brutal 4 years. Sky Dragon, in addition to legal problems that he has, he's coming under attack. He flees.
Goes back to Hong Kong, I think.
Yeah, he flees to Hong Kong. One of his street bosses or acting bosses, guy named Michael Kwong, he's assassinated in 1989. And White Devil John is sent to New York. I think he fought on the front lines of this thing for a short period of time, and then Johnny Joe, I guess, viewed, you know, not saving him, but protecting him. The best way to protect him was to get him out of town.
Yeah, that's interesting. It'd be interesting to, I haven't read the book, I admit, but like, he just, according to some of my research, there was like, Chinatown is too hot. You got to go to New York. But it'd be interesting to find out a little bit more details about like, is like, you left Boston because it was too hot from law enforcement, or because people are getting killed, or like, it's not very clear. Yeah. Maybe it is if you read the book, but regardless, he does end up in New York during this period. And that's important to the story.
Right. So he ends up under the tutelage of the Lau brothers, Jackie and Pete Lau, who are Hung Moon guys. And remember, Sky Dragon was Hung Moon before he started Ping Ong. Now, that brings us to winter of 1991, and really the apex, I would say, of tensions in the underworld. And it erupts in January of 1991, winter of 91, with what became known as the Tyler Street Massacre, execution of five Chinatown gangsters that were there from out of town, I believe. There's still a lot of confusion about exactly what happened. And who, and I know they're still looking for, like, one of the triggermen is still unaccounted for in terms of.
Yeah, the shooters fled almost immediately, fled the country.
Right. But then a couple of them have been caught.
Yeah,
right. And another one, they're still looking for, like, now. I saw there was an article from a year or two in the Boston Globe. Trying to find one of the final suspects in the Tyler Street Massacre. And John Willis was, at that point, had just recently returned to Boston and had become very close. This is a part of the story that is fact, backed up by the just tremendous amount of evidence plus his own interviews. He became Tan Noh's right hand man, top enforcer, bodyguard, driver. And Tan Noh was Vietnamese. He led this
insurrection, whatever you want to call it.
And when John Willis came back, he was on the other side. So it's like he left as Ping Ong, but kind of came back in a way as what they became known as Hoi Ping, which was Tan Goh's group, which was was supported by the Born to Kill gang in New York City.
Well, another thing that is interesting about this moment is when he goes to New York, he doesn't go to New York for, like, sightseeing. He once again, yeah. I mean, he has been, then becomes fully immersed in the Chinese underworld in New York City.
Right.
And they're using him as a, not only as a collector, but like to rob rival gambling dens and, you know, beat people up and things like that. But the reason why this is important is, in terms of scale, I'm not an expert on Asian organized crime by any means, but my understanding is, in terms of scale, NYC Asian organized crime is the big leagues,
right?
Compared to Boston, Chinatown.
I think it's San Francisco and New York are the two superpowers, and everybody else's cities, Chinatown, you know, is lesser than,
right,
in terms of underworld status.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, it makes sense. I mean, just like with the Italians, I mean, the five families are usually, that's the top of the line compared to any of the, I mean, maybe not Chicago, but like any of the other families, the Patriarchas, Detroit, you know, Philly, whatever. New York is the pinnacle. And so it makes sense in the, you know, Asian underworld, there would be a parallel there. So he's learning from the best of the best when he's in, and he uses those skills.
He also has some pretty good political instincts.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It seems like, yeah, for sure. So he when he goes back to Boston, I think he is also, pointing out some of the things that he learned in New York. And I don't want to say giving advice, that's not the right way to put it, but he's influencing some of the other guys in Boston based on what he observed in New York. Like, this is how the big boys do it. And that became useful in Boston, navigating through that underworld, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So the massacre happens in the early morning hours of January 12th, 1991. Five people are executed. I believe they were all Ping Ong or loyalists to Sky Dragon, who, again, wasn't in the United States at that point. He had already fled. According to interviews, when White Devil John has been asked about the Tyler Street Massacre, he has said he was delivered a message specifically that afternoon to stay out of Chinatown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The reports, and I'm just like Jimmy, I don't want to claim to be an expert on this subject, nor do I want to claim to be an expert on the Tyler Street Massacre. So please correct me in the comments if I'm misreporting this or twisting the narrative. I think, from what I can gather, the belief was that these Chinatown gangsters who were from San Francisco.
Yeah.
And the thought was working on behalf of Peter Chong, who's one of the most powerful Asian organized crime bosses the United States has ever seen.
He's a big deal.
And is trans, you know, is bicoastal. He's not trans,
and transnational. He's got Jews in Hong Kong, China. Right. Hong Kong is part of China, but like the Hong Kong, you know.
So the theory was because the Sky Dragon is out of town, his number one guy gets killed. The organization is under attack. That Peter Chong and his San Francisco group says, let's go into Boston and take over territory.
Mm-hmm.
And that this was the remnants of Ping An trying to fight back and get rid of interlopers, and it happens at a social club gambling hall on Tyler Street in the early morning hours of January 12th, 1991.
Yeah, I think it was like 2 a.m. or something like that.
Yeah. So that sets the scene, I think, for like the second act. So first we have, you know, White Devil John's ascent. And now you have like his power move in regards to going from a character in the story, but not anybody that got top billing. And even though, and part of the discerning between myth and reality is he was never a Chinatown boss,
mm-hmm.
but he was very close to Chinatown bosses, mm-hmm. specifically Tan No, mm-hmm. Bai Ming. They're the same person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, also something to point out is, you know, Boston, regarding the massacre specifically, Boston is, you know, people know probably who watch this channel, you know, Boston has a very colorful underworld. You have the Italian mafia, you have the Irish mob, you have outlaw bikers, you have black gangsters. And the reason why I point that out is this shook the city, five people being gunned down at like point blank rate. I mean, and this is for a city that's used to gangster shit and violent underworld shit. But this was pretty extreme.
The Boston Mafia at that time was at war as well.
Yes.
This is the exact same time. So it's like it was a powder keg.
Mm-hmm.
And White Devil John is able to navigate his way through this very complex underworld and intricate situation where he has his loyalty to Ping An and Johnny Joe and Sky Dragon's people, but is also in self-preservation mode and I think at the same time trying to stay alive and propel himself forward in the underworld as he gets into his 20s, because at that point he's about 21, 22 years old, and he realizes that it's in his best interest across the board, whether it be personal welfare or business in the crime game, hitching his trailer to the Vietnamese group, which became known as Hoi Ping, and Tan No, aka Bike Ming, is that's the move. And by 92, I guess, August of 92, federal agents watch as or observe, follow a 22-year-old White Devil John who, in his gold-plated Mercedes, picks up Tan No, that drives him to Logan International Airport to go get on a plane and go see Sky Dragon in Hong Kong, and I guess make peace from the 4 years of bloodshed, and he comes back to Boston allegedly with Sky Dragon's kind of quasi blessing to be the new godfather, and Ping Ong is done at that point, and Hoi Ping is the new king.
So, I mean, we'd have to ask an expert on you know, Asian organized crime, but so I wonder, does that mean that then, like, so like the 14K triad, like then this still has their sanction, like, so like to them it doesn't matter if it's Ping On or whomever. Yeah. I mean, because things shift, but 14K triads are still going to be at the top of the food chain, if that makes sense.
Well, it says it's again, you can read between the lines or read tea leaves. I mean,
yeah,
he's getting on a plane to go to Hong Kong.
Yeah.
He's a Vietnamese. He's going to, you know, just to seek an audience with Sky Dragon. So, I mean, yeah, Sky Dragon at that point was, I think, under indictment and on the run. They eventually nailed him in 94, I think. But at some point in 95, there becomes an issue. There were a number of, just like in any mob massacre or mob conflict, there's always going to be fallout and ripple effects from certain events and situations. And there were a number of fallout murders from the Tyler Street Massacre. I don't think it's ever been confirmed about the March 30th, 1995 murder of Hai Bo Le. And Hai Bo Le, also known as Perfect Paul, was a Chinatown gangster. There's been rumors that his murder had something to do with fallout from Tyler Street, which had happened 4 years ago. What is known, I guess, for sure is that he was a suspect both by law enforcement and by Tan No and White Devil John and their contingent was suspected of killing a lieutenant of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that murder had something to do with the fallout from Tyler Street, I don't know. There are rumors that it did.
Another thing that just I think about, it's not directly related to that specific situation, but it does tie in, is this Chinatown. I mean, we're talking about it. I mean, it's what, like less than a square mile or something like that?
Right. So very small.
It's fascinating to me how many gangsters they can cram into a small area. And gangsters that have different factions and don't all get along with each other. It seems like a very, like, as you put, like powder, like a very combustible situation when you have a small geographic, you know, small geography we're talking about, and a lot of different gangsters and they're competing for limited resources. It seems inevitable, like you're going to have some of these confrontations.
So March 30th, 1995. Hai Bo Le, aka Perfect Paul, disappears, is kidnapped, and shortly thereafter, his badly battered body, dead body, is found in a ditch in New Hampshire. He had been strangled, beaten, stomped, shot. His throat had been cut. Pretty brutal homicide. The Tonno and White Devil John group were immediately considered suspects, and they're still considered suspects 30 years later. I wish I had more context to add to that, but I don't.
I think there's another thing to add here about the reason why I think people think that this is an interesting case study. Not only you have this white, this Irish dude who thrives in the Asian underworld, but White Devil John becomes a major drug kingpin in his own right as an independent operator.
Yeah, we're going to get you. That's the last quarter of this. We're going to get into that after this. So this is kind of, like I said, this is kind of like the second act, and then we're going to go to the third act. So that's spring of 95, March 30th, 95. And he has to go to prison intermittently between. So let's say his run on the streets was from, let's just say, 88. Let's just, I mean, he was around before that, but let's just say when he turned 18, 88 to 2011, which is it's a nice, that's 23 years. But it was, there were intermittent time behind bars.
Yeah, he took some assault cases and.
Yeah, and I think a drug case. So he was in prison on and off throughout this time period. And he comes back in the 2000s. And this is at a time when the drug economy, the drug market, just like back in the 80s with crack, is evolving in a direction geared towards pills, both pain pills and party pills, like Molly and that kind of stuff to go rave with. And then, you know, Oxycontins, Vicodins, Percocets and stuff like that. So he comes back and really dives, head first into that aspect of being a mobster. And I don't know if this is something that you take pride in or not. I guess it's kind of a dubious distinction that he's looked at as one of the real pioneers in New England, who was at the forefront of this new drug epidemic, which now is just so out of control. And he really opened up a lot of doors for different groups, and kind of blueprinted a little bit about how you do it. And this was all in the 2000s, before we were at this kind of a pill crisis.
Yeah. And according to him, my understanding is that the local Chinatown mob did not want to get heavily into narcotics for the similar reasons you hear with other crime groups. It's too much heat. It's too dangerous. So that he was keeping he was running this on his own. This was not sanctioned by the local Chinatown mob.
Well, and
in Boston.
Right. And he gets into a relationship with a Vietnamese woman who is, I believe, was a niece or a quote unquote niece of Baik Ming, or somebody that he looked after. And this is something that helps raise his stock as well. And he comes back from prison. He's got kind of a new approach. He gets a woman on his arms who's completely, she wasn't like a ride or die. Like, she wasn't like doing crime with him.
No.
He was keeping her shielded from that. And as Jimmy said, it was an operation that grew fast, and was semi-rogue, if not. It might have started with some form of sanctioning, but by the end, he was his own entity on the street. And I know that there was some friction with some people that where he was like, listen, I did my time as a secondary character, and now I want to be the main character and pocket the riches of being that main character.
Yeah, I think I don't think it's just from, you know, I'm interested in these like sort of comparative analysis of crime culture, but I don't think it was something where like the local Chinatown mob in Boston, like you know, it's a death penalty if you deal drugs. It's just they preferred to not get heavy into it. So that's why he was doing this on his own. But I do believe he did have some connections still to the Chinatown mob in New York City.
Yeah,
that was that, and they were less timid about getting into narcotics.
And he was doing business with a number of different OC groups. Yeah. It's just a matter of who he was speaking for. And again, to be clear, Tan No, aka Bai Ming, was indicted with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
they went down in the same case. Now,
right.
Now, Ming did not have to. His offenses in the actual indictment were actually considerably lesser, and that's why he did. I think he only did 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that even though he was higher in rank in Chinatown than White Devil John, probably significantly higher.
Right.
He was lower in terms of the indictment.
Yes. Yeah, right.
But he was indicted with him.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about Chinese organized crime groups. I don't know if this is like a Godfather myth, like the Italians don't deal drugs, which of course is I refer to it as a myth because it's not true. So I don't know. I mean, this could be the same. I just know from my research there was this notion that the Chinese guys or Vietnamese guys, either way, in Boston didn't want to get directly involved in drugs. But that could be some Godfather mythology. Like I don't know.
Well, I just want to be like, so again, this is some of where we're differentiating between myth and reality and what's real and what's urban legend. And the Godfather was indicted in the case.
Yeah.
With John Willis. And it's also interesting. And there's always these like things that seem like they're diametrically opposed, or they seem like something that isn't diametrically opposed, but it's actually the other way around. So for a guy that was undoubtedly sharp, I mean, he had very sharp instincts in being a mobster. He adapted, you know, better than anybody could have ever adapted in that particular circumstance. Ingratiated himself, showed that he was an opposer, that he was a, you know, the real deal. Showed he was capable. Showed he knew how to make money. It looks like though he had, and this doesn't necessarily make sense to me. It appears when you look about how the bus came about and a lot of the things they were able to nail him on were simply money laundering charges where he clearly didn't understand the law. If you know, when you read the book, and he even says it, I think, in some of the interviews he's done about not understanding how if you get caught with hundreds of thousands of dollars, why is that a crime? And I understand for a regular person, they don't understand that. But if you're somebody that's making your life,
Al Capone about.
I mean, if you're somebody that is, you're making your life as a criminal, especially at that level of organized crime, you would think you would have a firmer grasp on what is and isn't legal when it came to money. And he kept on getting caught up in going on planes or getting caught driving back and forth, or other people driving back and forth from Florida, bringing money and drugs up to New England. And he was like literally dumbfounded by it. Like he didn't, at least this is my interpretation. I apologize if I'm misinterpreting this, but it seemed like he was very uneducated in what he could or could not travel with, or what was or wasn't going to be considered a crime.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one thing to point out also is just, you know, the reason why Florida during this time, that's where the pill mills were,
right,
were from.
No, yes.
Florida's at the time, it was completely unregulated. So you didn't even have to be a physician, and you could set up a clinic basically. And as long as you had some kind of doctor, you know, as a figurehead affiliated with it, you could write prescriptions for you could write prescriptions for a shit ton of pills. And that also gets murky because that was legal in Florida. That was legal. It wasn't legal to sell those pills to people that didn't have a prescription, but in Florida, those were technically legal prescriptions that were, right, that they were writing.
They hadn't fully, from a legal perspective, they had, right, not fully understood how to weaponize against pill mills.
Yes, 100%.
Because there was ways to circumvent and, yeah, end around and but so I apologize if I'm misconstruing this. I got the feeling that in his interviews he was kind of saying like, I should have known better.
Yeah.
I was, again, naive to not have a better understanding of what I could and couldn't do. But for the audience, we shouldn't assume, just like the only reason I would assume he would know, because this is, you know, his freedom was on the line. So I would, but if you're just a regular person, you don't understand the law. So let's be very clear. If you get caught with a large sum of cash, not caught, if you're stopped in a car on a, you know, for speeding, and they ask to look around your car and they find a duffel bag with $200,000, a lot of people would be like, so?
Yeah.
I have $200,000. If you can't account for where that kind of money is, the government has the right to assume that that money is made by illegal means and you're not paying taxes on it. So anytime the government, whether it's in your house, in your car, on your person, anytime you're found with a large sum of cash, that's illegal. Unless you can show a receipt that I just won this at the blackjack table at Caesar's.
I don't have that problem. I'm lucky if I have $200 on me when I get pulled over, let alone $200,000.
I've heard it, though. It's not just him either. I've heard it from so many different people that make a living in crime that don't completely understand that you need to be able to account for every cent.
Well, I thought, I mean, all kidding aside, I mean, I was joking about Al Capone, but I thought that was pretty much, everyone knows that Al Capone, I mean, that's sort of like the baseline example of, you have to account for the money you have, or else you're going to be indicted.
I understand from a layman's perspective, though, why you could think to yourself, well, I could get this money, could come from any legal means. Like, there are a tons of ways I can make money legally. Why do I have to prove to you that this money that I have, that you can't, You can't prove the other side.
Right. The presumption, there's a presumption of guilt there, which maybe is not, maybe that's not even fair. I mean, we have to talk to like a lawyer, I think that's the civil libertarian lawyer or whatever. But
I can see you being like, it's cash.
Yeah.
You know, there's no you can't find any drugs. You don't find any guns.
Right.
I didn't kill somebody. I didn't hurt somebody. It's just cash.
Yeah.
But federal government uses that to say, well, actually, didn't they? There's a scene in Scarface, right? Where he says something about you can't, you know, I'm the best lawyer that you can have in South Florida, and you're never going to convince a jury that you just found $250,000 in a taxi cab.
So it does, the burden of proof is on you, the suspect, or the, you know, whether that's fair from a civil libertarian perspective, but it's, that's how it is.
So he goes down in 2011. He was locked down from 11 until just a couple weeks ago. Now he's free, and we obviously wish him the best of luck. We'd love him to come on and tell his story on OG Pod. So the invitation's out there, and just want to make sure we get everything right. Please let us know, everybody that might have some first person knowledge of this. To tell us what we got right and what we got wrong. We're both
fascinating. I mean, hopefully they make a movie of this or something. You know, hopefully.
Well, there's been plans, I think, to convert this into a film. I know originally James Gray had been tasked by one of the studios, and James Gray did all those great Joaquin Phoenix, Mark Wahlberg.
Movies. Oh, We Own the Night or something. Night
and the Yards, which I like, with James Caan and Wahlberg and Phoenix. He did a couple other ones that were pretty. He did one with Tim Roth about the Irish mob called, I think it was called Little Odessa. Not Irish, sorry, Russian.
That would be Russian,
yeah. Russian mob. It does a lot of gritty New York crime stuff.
Yeah.
But that was 10 years ago, and I don't think that project still has any life. I wouldn't be shocked if another studio or production company has the rights to it. And I have no doubt, like you said, this one day we will see.
Yeah.
We will see.
It'd be a cool TV show. You could see, because there's so many layers to this. A movie maybe wouldn't even do it justice. It would be good to see like several episodes, you know.
We should do it. Jimmy, you and I should do it.
I'd be happy to. We got to find someone with money.
But I have no doubt. Just like I said with the White Boy Rick case. Now it sucks the way that the Hollywood film turned out, that it wasn't very good and not a lot of people saw it. Yeah. I'm very proud of the documentary you can see on Netflix, which I executive produced. I worked on both the Hollywood film and the doc. The doc is considerably better. You can check it out on Netflix. But, you know, I even though it turned into a shit fest, I knew some way, one way or the other, the White Boy Rick story was too crazy to not become a film. And I same thing with White Devil John. There's just no doubt that either a film or a TV show will eventually be made about this. It's just a
matter of
who and when.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, JB, thank you for joining me, buddy. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I hope everyone out there is doing well. Nice to see everyone again. And hopefully we'll find another topic at some point. In the meantime, I'm just working on all my academic research on the Sicilian Mafia. So doing my thing.
Well, like I said, this was an OG's episode of the OG. The doctor, Jimmy Bucciolato, back in the house, at least for temporarily this summer of 25 for this episode. I had a really good time. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I hope we shared some knowledge and were able to discern and cut through some of the what was real and what was mythology. But the fact that you have mythology surrounding your name, that just by itself speaks to what a great story you have. Well, thank you, Jimmy. Enjoy the rest of the week. For Jimmy Bucciolato, for Ben Augusta, my MVP VIP producer, Original Gangsters Podcast. Please like, share, and subscribe. Scott Bernstein, Original Gangsters Podcast, uncovering the underworld, one city, one region, one country at a time. We're out.